the altimeter, your panel's most underappreciated instrument. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. We're starting the week off with Bob Miller, who is a certified flight instructor based in the Buffalo, New York area, and who publishes Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We'd like to start the week off with Bob and talk about safety topics to kind of get our head on straight for the week. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Well, Happy New Year, Paul, and Happy New Year to all who are listening.
All right. Well, thank you. In your December issue of Over the Airwaves, you had a couple of things I wanted to talk about. The first one was an article you entitled Altimeters, the Unsung Heroes of All Instrument Approaches. And this article was based on the experiences of a very high-time pilot who had a very bad outcome.
Yes, this was a case of an 18,000-hour airline pilot who was operating an RV-6 into a small airport with a 500-foot ceiling, obviously on an instrument approach, and missed on his first attempt, and then on the second attempt had a very, very bad outcome where apparently he struck a parallel taxiway and with tragic consequences. And when you read the accident report on unfortunately many of such accidents, you wonder how in the world did the pilot get below the published minimum descent altitude or decision height. And the answer to that question has to lie in his or her observance of the altimeter at that fateful moment, or more importantly, perhaps not the timely look at the altimeter, which makes that instrument probably the most critical one on the panel just as we approach that critical low altitude.
Well, I feel the need to pull us off in a tangent for just a moment, Bob, because anytime we see accident reports, the NTSB is very careful not to be too specific or forceful in laying blame. And in a lot of the cases, it's a year before they even try to determine a probable cause. And then they also list a bunch of other contributing factors and kind of water it down. And what I have to note here is that there's a controversy surrounding the premature analysis of accidents. But what I've observed and what's useful to me is that even if you consider it in an abstract and don't try to attribute a particular cause to this particular accident, we can learn things from accidents that can spur us to think about these things that could apply in our case, even if they turn out not to have in the case of the person we're talking about.
Well, I think you're touching upon a very valid criticism, Paul. It is bad form to try to attribute blame to an accident before the NTSB has completed its final probable cause report. But also, you're absolutely right. We can look at the circumstances, just the raw circumstances of any given incident or accident from a preliminary NTSB report and say, are there lessons learned that we can abstract from those facts, again, without attempting to lay blame? One thing that I look at is whenever reading any of these reports is you do get from the report the experience level of the pilot. And when the pilot is a student pilot, you can read the report with one from one perspective. But when you read a report that's involving a highly experienced pilot, that causes us to wonder even further what possibly could have gone wrong in a scenario like that.
Well, we know, too, that just by looking at accident statistics, that accident rates tend to plateau as experience as a pilot increases. And in some cases, we actually reach points where our safety level dips with experience as we go through complacency.
The complacency rule applies. I think there are data that shows, you know, the accident rates kind of spike up rather steeply in the first 200 hours and then level right off until we get to some number above $6,000 or $8,000, and they seem to go back up again. And complacency is something that we've talked about in the past, you and I, Paul, and it's something that we all have to watch out for as pilots. But in the accident that we're talking about here, or in the scenario that we're talking about here, nonetheless, for whatever reason, this airplane, the only reason it should have legitimately gone below the published minimum descent altitude or the decision height is one of two reasons. One, the runway environment was in sight and the pilot elected to go below and continue on in his landing, or something went terribly wrong in the airplane, an autopilot malfunction, an engine failure. Tailplane icing is another factor that I don't think we've talked about, but that certainly has been a contributing cause. But in this particular example, the point I was making in the article, let's just assume everything was operating properly. The airplane was operating properly. There was no icing involved. It was a hand-flown approach. No autopilot was involved. And for some reason, the airplane went below the decision height and missed the runway, which suggests that it went below the decision height without the runway environment being in sight.
All right, let's talk about what happens to experienced airline pilots who seem to gravitate on weekends and time off to something where they can get their hands on a stick and rudder. Is this just a matter, perhaps, and again, this is speculation, not to cast blame on this pilot or to try to analyze what he did, but to learn, you know, just get tips from what we can to know what we should not do. Is it possible that he's got so many other options to look at in the cockpit of what he flies on his day job that looking at the altimeter or even perhaps in some cases remembering to set the Colesman window can slip by?
I think so. Absolutely. Category 3 approaches in an airliner is a fairly routine exercise for a properly trained pilot. It's simply watching the gauges as the runway, as the tires kiss the runway. But when transitioning from a highly capable aircraft with an automated system to a hand-operated airplane such as an RV6, we're talking the difference between driving a Hummer and driving a moped. In this particular case, just the sight picture that might exist, the difference between a 747 that lands two stories above the ground versus an RV6 that lands 3 or 5 feet above the ground. But here again, I think the point that I'm trying to make is for the GA pilot, the single engine aircraft operator who is not a professional pilot. He or she is flying an instrument approach in low IFR conditions. What instrument? We should of course have a good scan on all of the instruments, but what is the one instrument that can ultimately lead to our undoing? And in my opinion, it has to be the altimeter. The altimeter, we're going down to 200 to 500 feet just above the ground on the basis of that instrument alone, moving at anywhere from 90 to 120 knots at a sink rate of 400 to 600 feet per minute. Things are happening very, very quickly, and the number one problem with an altimeter might just simply not looking at it at the critical time. Number two, and you mentioned the Colesman window, we may have an incorrect altimeter setting in the altimeter in the first place. And then number three, we may not have briefed the approach plate properly. We may have a little bit of mental dyslexia going on where the MDA on the published approach plate says 295 feet, and we read it as 258 feet. And those few feet difference could, of course, account for an untimely hitting of the ground.
Well, and obviously a problem not so much for a guy like who was in this circumstance, but for somebody who doesn't fly IFR often, and this gets back to staying proficient and staying current, is that there could be a tendency, if you don't land often in these conditions, to fixate on the course deviation indicator.
Well, yes, and fixating on any gauge, of course, is a no-no in instrument flight. But there's another factor going on. I mean, the variables are extant. We can go on and on and on, but there's a certain amount of predestination mindset that we can get into. The predestination mindset is we're going to land, and we're going to land on this approach regardless. And it's almost the subconscious will to put the airplane on the ground. And we'll do that, and when we do that, it causes some pilots to maybe cheat a little bit on the minimum descent altitude or the decision height and just consciously go below it in hopes of finding the runway. One of the techniques that I try to instill in my instrument pilots is the mindset that we're not going to get in, that any time we commence an instrument approach, particularly to minimums, we're talking to ourselves in our inner ear, I'm not going to get in, I'm not going to get in, I'm going to go missed, I'm going to go missed. And then you're all ready for that eventuality, but upon reaching the minimum descent altitude or decision height, lo and behold, there are the runway lights or there's the airport environment, and it becomes a sudden kind of a bonus that I am going to get in. Life is good.
You could even take that a step back farther and say, I'm not going to get into that airport.
Yes. I mean, the what-if planning that we need to be doing in all phases of flight is if everything goes to pot in a hurry, this is what I'm going to do. And then just assume that it's going to go to pot. Just assume that we're going to get a rough running engine at the improper time. I was coming in last week in my Cessna 210 to my home airport in the very low IFR conditions, and it was questionable whether or not I was going to be able to make it in because of the low ceiling. I had also been fighting incredible headwinds for the previous 3 hours in the flight. So I found myself in a position where I was arriving at night, low IFR, with less than optimal fuel. It wasn't a point where I was ready to declare a low fuel emergency, but it was something that I didn't really want to miss on this approach. In my own mind, I wanted to get in. And as I lowered the gear inside the final approach fix, I had an unsafe gear warning light. And now I'm thinking, this is going bad in a hurry. Fuel at night, low IFR, and now I have an unsafe gear warning light. And so immediately your mind springs into, all right, what am I going to do first? Low fuel suggests that, you know, I don't want to prematurely abort and fly off to an alternate where I may have a fuel timing issue. Okay, the instinctive thing to do would be recycle the gear. Okay, raise the gear, lower it one more time. And on the when I did that, all three green lights came in, and it was a landing that I was happy to have completed successfully and safely. But you see, anything can go wrong, and the truly proficient pilot, and I'm not saying I'm the most proficient pilot out there by a long shot, but you have to be spring-loaded to figure out what are you going to do at any point along that flight when something isn't going right.
All right, one of the other related topics on which you wrote recently was when a missed approach procedure is not a missed approach procedure, and we'll talk about when that procedure is not the first thing you should go to in just a moment. Talking today with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking today with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. Bob, recently you wrote an article with the title, When a Missed Approach Procedure is Not a Missed Approach Procedure. You're talking about a circumstance where coming into final approach, your IFR, and you reach the missed approach point, you have the runway in sight, you continue descending, and then suddenly the airport disappears again. First of all, how often does this happen? And second, why is this a problem?
Well, as far as it happening often, I must say I have never personally experienced that event, but it could happen. Certainly when you're at the missed approach point, you've gone beyond the missed approach point, you're fully intending on landing, and then all of a sudden a lake effect snow shower passes over the field, or for some reason you lose visual contact with the field. So the standard thing to do, of course, is to execute the published missed approach instructions, or whatever the tower gave you as a missed approach instruction. But there's a technicality in the missed approach instruction procedure that many of us have not been taught or are not aware of. That is found in the FAR AIM section 5.4.21 regarding missed approach. The missed approach begins at the published missed approach point, not beyond that. And I'm reading now from the FAR, from the AIM. It says, initiating a go-around after passing the published missed approach point may result in a total loss of obstacle clearance. And when that happens, we now are in a bit of a no-man's land. We're going to have to revert back to something known as the departure procedure, which is something we're not looking at unless we're taking off. But having the departure procedure in mind, in the event that we have a late missed approach, could save us from a problem with obstacles. Now, certainly not in the flatlands of the East or the Mid-Continent, but when we're out in mountainous areas where it where obstacles are a major factor, we need to revert immediately to that departure procedure in order to ensure obstacle clearance. Now, as I say that, there is a there is another problem, and that other problem is we're not going in a direction that ATC expects us to be going. They're expecting us to be following the published MIST. Okay, so now we're in a quandary. Do we satisfy the requirements of ATC and the procedures, or do we satisfy the requirement of missing an obstacle?
Well, and now in this circumstance too, Bob, that old aviate, navigate, communicate priority list may get swapped around a little bit, because at some point you've got to set some priority on letting ATC know what you're doing.
Yes, and absolutely. But the first procedure, the first priority is to aviate. Now, again, for pilots who've gone into Eagle, Colorado, or other mountainous areas, Aspen, Colorado, for example, we absolutely have got to make job one obstruction clearance. And so the departure procedure is typically placed there to for the purposes of avoiding obstacles. The missed approach instruction that we have is primarily an ATC requirement that puts airplanes where they're expected to go so as not to run into another aircraft. Separation, that's their job. So admittedly, we're into a bit of a no man's land here, but if we parse the rules, the rule is that the published missed approach procedure begins at the missed approach point. And the first word in every missed approach instruction, no, 99% of every missed approach instruction is climb. So the drafters of the procedure, the TERPS guys that develop the procedure, anticipate a climb immediately at the missed approach procedure in order to achieve a gradient that will get them over the obstacles. Now, that 1% of those missed approach procedures where the first word isn't climb, the first word is immediately climb. So now in a case like this, we know we have obstacles out there that require an immediate climb added for emphasis. Now imagine starting that climb late because we're halfway down the runway before initiating the missed approach procedure. That missed approach procedure may no longer be adequate. We then have to revert over the to the departure procedure. This all, by the way, comes in under the heading of your pre-landing checklist. Knowing, briefing not only the published arrival procedure, the instrument procedure, but looking elsewhere in the charts and plates for something known as the departure procedure. And I'd just like to throw in a word of caution right here, if I may, Paul,
sure,
on a very related subject. There's now many of us who are flying on glass cockpit airplanes where we have the procedures on the multifunction display, and no longer are we required to carry paper plates, paper approach plates. That puts a lot of information up on the multifunction display in pages where the published departure procedure may not be appearing on the plate that we're looking at on the multifunction display. So
right.
here would be a case where the pilot may not know where the departure procedure can be found.
If you're coming in, you lose sight of the airport environment and have to execute a departure procedure, you may not be over the runway.
You better be on the arrival course or the extended center line of the runway leading to the runway, or directly on the runway, directly above the runway. If neither of those cases exist, then you truly have botched the approach. In other words, your localizer needle is off left or right, and that's another set of problems that compound what we've just said. And yes, then we do have a nasty situation. A word of caution to all of us who are out there operating in mountainous areas or in airports where there are surrounding obstacles. This is no place to be low and not knowing exactly where you are. And again, this is a point that I try to instill in my instrument students. Never descend another foot in the airplane unless you know precisely where you are. And if we're coming down and we do not have a centered localizer needle, we're three-quarter scale, stop the descent at that point. Just don't go any lower until you know exactly where you are. And if we all did that, then of course we would this business of controlled flight into terrain would hopefully go away. Just one last point, and it's the one you were touching on that came to mind as you were talking about it, and that's the infamous circling approach. Now, here is a situation that the problem is made far worse because we are deliberately moving off of the runway center line to turn left or right around the airport, and then we lose the airport in the middle of the circling approach. That adds another whole dimension to what we've just been talking about, Paul.
Well, and Bob, if these accidents all stopped, we could probably devote this time to a new feature about the explosive growth of general aviation and pilot starts.
Well, that would result, believe me. I believe that firmly. If we could stop the accidents, I believe general aviation, we would see a resurgence like we've never seen before. I think that's one of the major inhibiting factors of our precious industry, the public's perception of the relative safety of little airplanes. If that perception would improve, I think we would see a tremendous resurgence in GA.
Well, Bob, we always appreciate your sometimes unique viewpoint. I look forward to talking to you more throughout 2008.
Thanks, Paul, very much.
Bob Miller is a CFII who's based in the Buffalo, New York area and puts out Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. You can find out more at www.overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.